And with that good omen, I'm about to tell you more about Linda Schuyler Ford, who has three names, and we can never tell which one to call her. She's been a storyteller for over 20 years. She grew up in Sleepy Hollow, New York, and was immersed in Dutch and German folklore of her ancestors. Now she lives in Florida, correct?
Yes.
Yes, because I get to see wonderful pictures of her on Facebook in balmy spots. And Schuyler now presents day and weekend training and retreats for healthcare professionals using storytelling as a therapeutic intervention with Alzheimer's patients and as a lifeline against burnout, which all of you who talk about that your experience with this must know a lot about that. She is also a full-time, and she said a 50-plus hours a week. I don't know if you put the plus in, but I know it's there. She's a therapeutic recreation director and certified dementia practitioner. Schuyler is sensitive to the needs and abilities of audiences with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. And so she offers lively, interactive programs that use props, audience participation, and therapeutic techniques to engage these audiences that are experiencing mid-stage to late cognitive loss. She travels with these, does storytelling workshops for staff, and she also has a particular technique that maybe she'll have time to tell us about called Art Talk. So she's been working with recreational staff, social workers, CNAs, nurses to calm and redirect residents through using that approach. I don't want to take up any more time. I'd like to turn it over now to Linda Schuyler Ford.
Thank you so much. It is an honor.
We're all going to mute. I forgot that. Star six, okay, everybody?
I'm thrilled to be in such rich company, and I do hope afterward all of you will reach out to me through email so that I can stay in touch with you, because you all are doing such wonderful work. One of my favorite quotes, good old Maya Angelou, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. Boy, did that come home for me when I started working in long-term care as a therapeutic recreation director close to 30 years ago. Recreation directors are responsible for gathering personal histories of any resident who's admitted to a nursing home or moves into an assisted living community. And often we are, and I don't say this defensively, at the bottom of the pecking order. Obviously, nurses and doctors need to get in there and assess people and make sure that their medical needs are taken care of. If a person has had physical therapy or occupational therapy ordered, then those therapists need to have immediate contact with a new resident and work up an assessment. And so invariably, even though most state regulations, federal regulations require that a personal history be completed and in somebody's medical chart within 14 days, that's a challenge. And when a healthcare industry is, especially a long-term care industry, is as heavily regulated as ours is, it's tough to embrace the intent of the law rather than just the letter of the law. So it's get as much information as you can so that you're in compliance, get it in the chart, and done. And, oh gosh, we lose so much in that way. You probably have seen on Facebook, good old Facebook, a film clip with Naomi File, who is a Jewish white woman singing a hymn to an African American Christian woman, and it's beautiful and it's moving, and the whole point is missed. Although the blurring of boundaries between race and religion is moving and wonderfully beautiful to see in that film. Naomi File's life work has been what she calls file validation therapy. It's File, F-E-I-L, and her program is File Validation. And she started this work gosh, probably more than 30 years ago when she became a social worker working in the nursing home where her mother had been an administrator when Naomi was growing up. And sadly, one of her first clients as a social worker in this nursing home was a woman who lived there when she was a child, when Naomi was a child, and Naomi remembered her. And now the woman had become demented, and much of what she said didn't make sense. Now, going forward, I'm a little off with the details, but what Naomi discovered, this woman kept saying, crick, 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 or crack, 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 something that seemed like a nonsensical syllable. But she was very agitated when she repeated this. And Naomi felt that it wasn't just the random calling out of someone with dementia. She felt that there was some significance. And she spent a lot of time and effort contacting this woman's family members and lifelong friends and pieced together that this woman, as a child, had a doll. And she wanted to take the doll to school with her on the first day. And her mother was very strict and not exactly brimming over with warmth. She yanked the doll out of the child's hand and said, no, you will not. If you're old enough to be in school, you're old enough to stop playing with dolls. She threw the doll in the trash. The child surreptitiously removed the doll from the trash and took it to school. During the course of the day, her mother realized that and charged down to the school, yanked the doll out of the child's hand yet again, and humiliated her in front of her friends. And the doll's name was Crick. So here we fast forward 75, 80 years to an unhealed wound, a shame that this child suffered and is now creeping back up into her consciousness in a way that is obviously causing her terrible anxiety and emotional pain. Obviously, this is an unusual circumstance, and we're not going to be able to go back and dig into that kind of past. But if we have a flow of someone's life and are able to fill in details as someone sinks deeper into a dementia, we can validate their worth as a person by knowing their story. One of the most powerful exercises that I ever participated in was we were in a small group and we were all asked to name a couple things we're proud of, people who are important in our lives, experiences that were very meaningful to us. And we were partnered. Half of us shared that. The other half of the group made a memory book for us based on what we shared. And then those of us who had shared our memories were told we could not speak. Either we had recreated symptoms of a stroke or dementia. And it was incredibly powerful to have someone hold up a picture album and know my name and know that I have a labradoodle and rescued rabbits, that I love to kayak. All of a sudden, somebody outside of this broken body knew me. And, you know, if storytelling is about connection, and if listening, true listening, is about connection and knowing someone, boy, if nothing else taught me how important it is to know somebody's history, that did it. And so I began to play with different ways of bringing people's stories forward, because obviously in the first 36 hours or 2 weeks in a nursing home, people are not inclined to sit down and say, hey, grab a beer. Let me tell you this. It takes time, and it takes trust, and it takes play. And in fact, play and props are two ways that stories bubble to the surface. If you are working with people who are new to Alzheimer's disease, caregivers or professional staff, there's a marvelous book, and I'm sure you know it, Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge by Mem Fox. Spectacular, vibrant watercolor illustrations. And it's about a little boy who lives next to a retirement home, and he learns that someone has lost their memory. And so he asks different people what a memory is. And they share, a memory is a feather, a memory is a stone. It's a beautiful story. And in training people, when I worked, volunteered with the Alzheimer's Association Connecticut, we would read that story and then put several props on, word finding, see, happens to all of us, on a tray, a stone, a seashell, a baby doll. And everybody got to pick one prop and tell what memory that triggered in them. And from there, stories grew. Sometimes it was a sentence, sometimes it was paragraphs, but we could revisit that. We could revisit that. And each time, more stories bubbled to the surface. One of my favorite quotes, and I have heard Jolene Brakey say this, but I know it's also attributed to Maya. People may forget what you said, but not how you made them feel. I heard Jolene Brakey say that during a workshop. She is a remarkable educator who has written a book, Creating Moments of Joy. And again, you know, we go back to, if story is connection, then people are going to remember not what we said, but even people with Alzheimer's disease and memory loss, cognitive challenges, will remember that they were listened to. They will remember that connection with you, and that ripples out and out long after the event has taken place. Personal stories are one way of connecting, but folk tales as well, and people even into probably the late middle stage of dementia get humor. They get irony. They understand metaphors. And so folk tales, especially folk tales with repetition, are marvelous and valuable in working with folks. In sharing stories as a form of entertainment, but also as a jumping off place for then eliciting people's own memories. I have also worked with two groups of people with Alzheimer's disease in developing storytelling programs. And this is just amazing in terms of, you know, when you expect a lot of someone, they come through. And so this was good for morale, it was good for memory, it created a wonderful sense of camaraderie. But it also enabled the residents of an assisted living community, memory care program, an assisted living community, to become a theater troupe. One of the stories that they performed regularly is The Poor Tailor, you know, that story about the man who's given a bolt of cloth and he makes a coat and it gets worn out, so he makes a jacket, and that gets worn out, so he makes a vest. I think you all are pretty much storytellers, so you know it. The end of the story, of course, is, you know, he makes a button, and when that gets worn out, he has just enough left to make this story. And the ladies, and using the global deterioration scale, it's a great tool because it kind of pinpoints the cognitive losses in the clusters that they tend to occur. So if we're talking about people who are at a stage 4 or stage 5, people who cannot survive without assistance, stage 6, where they may forget names of significant people in their lives, may need cueing to get dressed, reminders to go to the bathroom, not be able to provide any self-care, even at that level of cognitive loss, muscle memory or procedural memory is very much intact. And so as these women learned the poor tailor, they would pantomime and repeat the line, and he measured and he measured and he measured, he cut and he cut and he cut, he sewed and he sewed and he sewed. And rehearsing that, they started talking about sewing and reminiscing, which was a lovely side effect, side benefit. But in rehearsing it, the muscle memory, the procedural memory of doing this over and over again enabled them to remember the sequence of the story. And then you add that we are not using the part of the brain that simply memorizes and spews things out. They talk about each of these tasks. They talk about envisioning it. I ask them, show me how you would act that out. So there's a different part of the brain engaged there. And then you add, when there's repetition like that and it's rhythmic and you can change the inflection with each phrase, that calls on the part of the brain where music lives. And boy, does music live. I work now with a client who can barely get a sentence out, but she can sing. Oh, she knows all the words to songs and she sings them beautifully. And you'll find the same with people being able to recite ballads and poems that they learned as children, long poems, well into significant progression of the disease. So we did have this group that took the story, The Poor Tailor, to a daycare center, and they performed it beautifully, and they knew they were on stage. It was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. If I had it to do over again, I would have taken away one lady's cell phone. She was doing fine, but her cell phone rang. And in the middle of this chorus of people all saying, and he cut, and he cut, and he cut, she answered the phone and began talking with her granddaughter. So, yeah, we're not quite perfect, but doing well. I also use picture books for older children, and so that nobody feels embarrassed or condescended to, I present it as a time when we're reviewing books that we're going to recommend. Henry's Freedom Box is marvelous, the story of Henry Box Brown, an escaped slave who shipped himself to Philadelphia. From there, after reading that story, people reminisced about when they had experienced discrimination. One woman shared a story about how her best friend growing up was black and this woman was white. And she didn't know there was any difference until they were five and sent to different schools. And the sensory memories were remarkable. And this, again, was a woman who was fairly advanced in her dementia and normally had significant problem with verbal communication, and yet the story flowed. It came from her soul, not from her mind. The repetition of phrases is a big deal. It's a great tool, and it can make a tremendous difference in people being successful. One other program that I present that is story/art-based is Art Talks. I was very fortunate to be able to take the Museum of Modern Art Meet Me at MoMA docent training, and I was so moved by it. I noticed that any people on the tour, and this is all for people with Alzheimer's disease and their caregivers, whenever they were standing in front of a piece of art that was being described and discussed, and they had a comment, they extended their arms with their palms up, So it seemed to me that there was a true physical connection with the painting, and people became wildly articulate. I tweaked that program, brought it back as a small group program, and have seen people, perfect example, I worked with Christina's World, the Andrew Wyeth painting, and people began talking about her clothes. She shouldn't be dressed like that to lie out in the grass. So there was remarkable awareness. They were quite discerning as they interpreted the symbols. And then somebody said, I think she's old. And they talked about her hair and described her waist as being that of a young woman. She was quite slender and wearing pink. But they talked about her hair and her posture and were so remarkably discerning in talking about this painting. From there, they made up a story about who she is, her name, where she lives, where she's going, why she's on the ground. And there were not just comments and observation and story making, but there was remarkable camaraderie. And this group that was meant to last for half an hour lasted for 90 minutes. For people with dementia to sit still for 90 minutes is a miracle. And it's a miracle born of story and art and listening and being interested. We're almost, I can't believe this. I told my husband, I'm going to have to talk for half an hour. I don't know if I can. And he laughed. I hope you all are laughing right now. We're just about where I can stop and we can have a conversation. But I did want to just share quickly that I do a lot of story programs for caregivers as well. And just came back from Massachusetts where I presented a program called Five Smooth Stones, taken from the Bible story about David and Goliath, and the fact that David, no matter what version you read, David is always described as selecting five smooth stones. And so the first half of that workshop, that is more of a support group, and we talk about the five tools that people rely on, whether they're external tools or character traits that they have that they call up. And then the second half of the program, I tell stories that represent those traits. So it's a little bit improv, a little bit scary, because I'm never sure where it's going to go. But one of the things that I close with that I think is meaningful to caregivers, y'all probably know that chant from from maybe Juba This, Juba That, or the Purple Cow book. We're going back like 35 years. Hi, my name is So, and I work in a button factory. I've got a wife and three kids, and one day my boss said to me, So, are you busy? I said, no. He said, push this button with your right hand. And then you go on. And, of course, you had the left hand and then the right foot and the left foot and the head. Caregivers, once we're a little bit in, so that nobody was self-conscious at that point, we do that. And we get very, very silly with it. Thank you very much. And then when we finish, I ask them please to think of themselves in that room with those people, all of us gathered around, doing this bit of silliness, and to remember that when they feel overwhelmed by multitasking. And of all of the work that I have done to prepare this kind of hybrid storytelling concert support group, of all the stories that I've rehearsed, of all the quotes that I've come up with, that is the one activity that caregivers write to me or email me months later and say, thanks, that worked. It just goes back to being silly, being able to laugh, being able to lighten up, whether it's through story or story movement or song. And then we go back to listening, hearing the person with Alzheimer's disease, hearing the caregiver, hearing the staff member who is shocked that they can't save the world. And on that note, I can hush for now. I would love to hear your comments, questions, insights, because you guys are the brain trust here. So unmute your phones, please.
So anybody have a question or comment about what we've talked about so far?
Hello? This is Glenda in Tucson. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, great. I wasn't sure that my muting was working. I found everything that you had to say to be really very interesting. And I'm particularly taken with the success that you've had with the caregivers. I wonder if you could just expand a little bit on how eager they are to attend your workshops.
You know, that has varied. I think the smallest group I have had was 15, and the largest was probably a little over 50. And, of course, you know, it's scary. Who is this woman? What's she going to do? Is she going to make me get up and say something? Within 15 minutes, people are a bit more relaxed, and the participation is good. It takes that long to get everybody to know they're not going to be put on the spot.
Well, great. I was just a little concerned that perhaps some people are attending on duress because they are so overworked. And, it's something new. It's rather akin to teachers in service. They're not sure why they really need to be there.
Yes, yes. And, you know, if nothing else, they've gotten out of the house for 90 minutes, but I hope that there is more. And, I try and open with a funny story, and I'm so in the serious, and I'm going to listen, and I'm really working on opening up and being empathetic, that it's hard for me to go to funny, you know, but I'm really working on building a repertoire of short, funny stories, because that's key. That is key. If you can get the group laughing at me or with me or at me again, that makes a big difference if we can start out with laughter.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Anyone else have some thoughts, questions, comments?
Oh, hi, Skylar. It's Elisa. And I just would love to hear some more examples of ways that you help to pull stories, just more experiences with different types of clients and maybe their family members getting involved.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Occasionally, I would do a group with family members. When I worked with Apple Rehab, which is based in Connecticut, they were quite forward-thinking and developed their own brand of the Eden Alternative. The Eden Alternative is a movement to create nursing homes that are resident-driven. You know, rather than breakfast is served between 7 and 8, it's when would you like breakfast? When do you usually take a shower? And, you know, it's much more than that. But
they created their own brand of it. And one of the pieces of that was what they called a community meeting. So at least twice a week, we would welcome as many staff members and as many family members as we could. And the community meeting would take a good hour. There was maybe 3 minutes of exercise, 3 minutes of current events. It was completely structured, but there was no one in charge. And at one point in the meeting, we always talked about something that we're grateful for, which normally would trigger some stories. You know, some people would say the same thing over and over again. I'm grateful for my family. I'm grateful for my faith. But there was always at least one story that rose to the surface through family or staff participation. And I think one of the keys to that is to embrace a truly interdisciplinary approach. You know, social workers have one piece of the pie, nurses have another piece of the pie, recreation, yet another. But nurses' aides are the unsung heroes in nursing homes. They are underpaid, horribly underpaid, and underappreciated. And because they share such a physical intimacy with residents, they are often the people who hear the stories. And so to include them in groups and to give them the opportunity to share what they know about a resident is a really big deal. So much has come from nurses' aides. So I truly think being interdisciplinary is key. You know, if you're not working in a facility or an institutional setting, create a support group, or not a support group, because then, you know, that sometimes raises a red flag of, you know, it's going to be clinical. I'm going to be under the microscope. But a social circle where people can share, people involved in the patients, and I don't like that word because they're more than just somebody with a disease, but, you know, neighbors, friends, people from church. It's key to get that information from anybody and everybody. I talked about the work I do with Art Talks, which is based on MoMA's Meet Me at MoMA. You know, okay, I can share this with you. In October, I was doing an Art Talks program with about 8 clients with Alzheimer's disease. And we looked at Jasper Cropsey's Staruka Viaduct, which is just a powerful painting to me. It's set in autumn. In the foreground, there are two men, a man and a boy, who are hiking with a dog, standing on a ledge, looking at the valley below, and a train passing on the viaduct on the horizon, and just almost on the horizon, beyond that, mountains, and it's fall, and the colors are rich and beautiful, and you can smell the air looking at this. We looked at that, we talked about it, and there was a bit of conversation, not a whole lot, and then the ladies composed a poem about this painting, which I have here. Now, these are women in mid-late stage Alzheimer's disease looking at a painting of men watching a train pass by in this beautiful autumn scenery. They wrote, "The genius is autumn, golden, breathtaking. There's a dog, an amble with a friend. Change can be beauty. Change is nice for a restless heart if you're inspired to run or to hop on a train or to stay and stay and stay forever."
Wow, that's beautiful.
It is. It's powerful. Mm. But your question reminds me, you know, that's one bit of beautiful creativity that came out of that painting. We looked at it again around Thanksgiving, so about 5 weeks had gone by. And two sisters, now they participated in that first group as well, but they saw something different. And this time they talked about how they used to take the train from Georgia down to Apalachicola, which is in the panhandle, the Florida panhandle on the coast. And they, this time, remembered that in great detail and told an entire story about how they would ride down and the smell, and they would get to Apalachicola, and the town would smell of fish. It was right on the coast. And they'd visit their cousin, and then they would ride back home on this train, and there were barrels of salted mullet. And they could describe the barrel with the hoops and the smell of the coal and the smell of the forest as they got closer to Georgia. And then they said, and we would always steal a couple fish and put them in our pocket and go home. And then from there, they remembered that it was salted fish and you had to soak it in cold water. And other women chimed in. So a complete story 5 weeks later that had been forgotten before. So this is my long-winded way of saying, go back. You're not done just because you've used one resource one time. Go back and let it be seen in a different light and let the stories bubble to the surface.
Right. Could I piggyback on that?
Please.
And share something from the work I've done with this project called Time Slips, which is very similar in approach to Meet Me at MoMA. And your story really resonates because what I notice is that because your first invitation to this group of women was not to remember a story, but to make a connection with art, which is based on imagination and emotion and just response that doesn't require remembering.
Yes.
That opened these floodgates to the story. And this happens in Time Slips a lot. Time Slips stories are all imaginative stories. We never ask, we're not asking people about their memories. And yet, just like your experience, after we start engaging with something that has nothing to do with any of us, all of a sudden memories come out. And I think part of that is that when you're losing, you know, when you've lost a lot of memory and people ask you about your memories, you freeze up because you're going to say the wrong thing or you're going to, and what you've done is just really, you know, your story conveys how it opens things up. So how both things, I mean, the memories that they shared were wonderful and also the creative writing, which was not personal but conveyed so much, you know, creativity, was also so wonderful. So what a great story.
They are remarkable. And yet you make a good point. You know, one of the first things we learn is you don't ask someone with Alzheimer's disease, hey, do you remember? You know, when you get to the questioning part, tell me about, or what do you think, or how do you feel, but not, hey, do you remember? So thank you. Yeah, that's an important reminder for me. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that you just do it naturally now, but I know when I started doing this work that learning how to ask questions in a way that is open-ended and not making people feel like they're being tested, because people do get asked questions a lot, right? You know, what day is it, who's the president, and things like that. I think it takes an effort to make sure that people understand that, I mean, the participants, that they're not being
asked any question that they can get wrong.
Yes, yes.
It just helps.
A kindred spirit.
Are there any other stories that you want to share with us?
You know, I was thinking of something and then it left me. All this memory talk. The only other thing, and this is related but not, is where somebody lives isn't who they are. Living in a nursing home doesn't define the person who lives in a nursing home. So I really encourage caregivers, whether it's professional or family members, to be a little bit outrageous, to be silly. What's the worst that can happen? And so I took a group of ladies in our little bus driving around downtown Danbury, Connecticut. And we were performing random acts of kindness. We were giving out ice cream cones to people on the street, just anybody. And, you know, this really speaks to opportunity more than story, but that's where our stories come from, is saying yes to opportunities and experiences. So we were having just such a silly, funny time. We were driving around trying to catch the trolley driver. One bus is a trolley car. And a couple weeks before, the trolley driver had taken a group of residents on a historic tour of downtown. And so we were trying to find him to give him an ice cream cone. And two things happened. Almost everybody on that bus, and I believe there were eight women, had dementia, but one woman who was multiply diagnosed with several mental illnesses. Matter of fact, she was like a walking DSM-4. God bless her, the most tortured soul I have ever known. And what we do in our society is when you're old, when we're old, that's the common denominator. You know, so now she's an old psych patient, and I say that with air quotes, not in a mean way. And so she's just old and was sent to live in a nursing home. You know, all other identifiers now are ignored or secondary. But this woman who sent nurses and social workers running from her room in tears had great compassion for the people she lived with who had dementia. And so she assigned tasks. I was out of a job. You hold the cone, you do this, you scoop the ice cream, you wave a napkin out the window. And one lady who had just moved in with us, her name was Marion, sitting with her purse clutched to her chest saying, "Oh, honey, this is dynamite. I love doing this. Let's give ice cream to people. This is dynamite." And we did. We drove around and gave out ice cream. We pulled in front of the county courthouse, and a marshal came up on the bus, and he said, "You know, I'm never outside this time of day. I'm so glad I'm here for ice cream." And after he finished his ice cream, he told the ladies, the only reason he's out right now, he was leaving work early to drive down to Bridgeport to look into buying an ice cream truck. And every one of those ladies, it was like in a cartoon, their heads all turned, their eyebrows went up, they got it. And one of them said, "Well, today I guess we get to be God's messengers. We're angels today." 3 years later, Marion, this is dynamite, was living in another nursing home closer to her daughter. And I had to go there on business. And, you know, there's this dance that you do with people with Alzheimer's. If you haven't seen them for a while, they may not recognize you, and it's fine. But if they do, then they have trouble placing you, and you know, you don't want to make them uncomfortable. So, do I know you? You maybe would say, well, yeah, I know your daughter. I met you with your daughter a time or two. And so there was Marion sitting at the nurse's station, and I did what I had to, and I turned, and her eyes flew open, and she said, well, hello. And I spoke with her, but I didn't, you know, I was waiting to see if she recognized me and what we needed to do to help her build that bridge. And she said, you know, I don't know what it is about you, but I'm thinking about ice cream. 3 years later, and again, this, it isn't a story. It's a story I'm working on now for a concert. But, you know, above all else, take risks. Let people continue to grow their stories. Not, you know, don't limit them by, you live in a nursing home. You're done. This is your world. The world can still be as big as they can make it, as caregivers can make it, and their story can continue to grow. And now I'm done.
Oh, that's a lovely story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, wow. It is. It's very inspiring.
I'm always going to think about ice cream now when I think of your name.
Yeah, isn't that great?
I love it. What a good connection.
We can add that to my string of names. Yeah, yeah. Just powerful, powerful stuff. You get out there and your story can still continue.
I have about 6 minutes. Is there any last comments, questions?
I would love to hear from anybody who wants to continue this conversation now or a month from now. It would be my pleasure. So, stories.
How can they best reach you?
Thank you.
How can they best reach you, Skylar?
My email address is stories, plural, storiesheal at gmail.com. My cell phone is area code 203-241.
You want this on the recording?
Sure.
Okay,
go ahead. It's my business phone, 203-241-7644.
There is a generous person.
Would love to continue this conversation. And thank you, everybody, so much for being here.
Any last thoughts or comments from our listeners?
Just thank you. Thank you. Very inspiring. Yeah, gives me more ideas.
Great.
Anybody else?
This is Glenda from Tucson. I'd like to say thank you very much for your wonderful stories. And I can tell that you share your compassion generously with the people you serve. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you. And let's talk more, Glenda.
Anybody else?
I'd like that. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, this is Liz in California. I look forward to connecting with you, too, and thank you so much. You, just like she said, your compassion, if it can communicate this well across this whatever you call this thing, a teleconference, you know, we can all almost bask in the glow of your commitment and your compassion. It's wonderful.
And the love of the people that you work with.
And the fun.
I think that's...
And fun. That's right.
Right? When people say to you, oh, it's so nice of you that you do this work for them. And it's like, no, actually, it's fun.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah, and meaningful.
Yeah.
It's not just an act of charity.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, I'm thrilled. Go ahead.
Going back, Mrs. Elisa, just one thing I forgot, but you were talking about nurses' aides, and I was a nurse's aide in my early 20s in a couple of nursing homes, and, you know, not necessarily so much people with dementia, but some, you know, just very, very quiet, and I'm sure there was some, and it's so true. We were the ones who were with people when they died, often, because the nurses were too busy. You know, we sat with them, and And we did hear their stories. You know, sometimes you have to sit with someone while they're going to the bathroom or whatever, and you just, you do. And I think
yes.
it's such a beautiful role, a beautiful role. And I know I just fell in love with all the people that I had the chance to do that with. And so it would be great to ask Mrs. Aides, you know, to share in their stories that what they've found out.
Yeah.
To feed them back
yeah.
to people, I think that would make them happy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, they're the unsung heroes. They're underpaid. They're overworked. They have, you know, I was going to say a poopy job, literally. You know, they need to know that they are valued not just for the physical work they do, but for the emotional and spiritual and intellectual work that they do as well.
Exactly.
And if you can help me spread the word that the workshop is available, I would truly appreciate it.
Okay. Well, Pat,
so there you heard it.
put it out on Healing Story Network again. Listserv. And
yes.
Let us know when you're coming to New England again.
Yes. I'm hoping after the first of the year to cut my hours to 2 days a week so that I can travel more. And we've got a grandbaby up there now, too, so there's some motivation.
Great. So they may be
all right.
gifted with you.
Thank you so, so much.
Well, you're
Thank
welcome.
Thank you both.
I would like to say to whoever is still on that on January 12th, we're going to have Michael McCarty talking about his work in California with the Corrections Department, helping inmates learn about telling their own stories. And then Elisa just sent me information about Carol Freya-Soth is going to talk on February 9th about The Path of the Hero, Navigating Life's Journey Through Story, Art, and the Hero's Journey, a program for incarcerated and at-risk youth. So that sounds very powerful on both those times, just like the
yes.
information we heard tonight. And our goal is to bring out this information for people that want to hear it and also to help connect storytellers that are working in similar venues. So thanks, everybody, for getting on tonight. Thank you so much, Skylar, for joining us and spending this time with us. And we hope you all will join us next month.
Thank